Telephoning New York, on the 8th of December 1988, on behalf of William English, ringing 01012125336686. The object of the exercise being that William has asked me to get a recording of an answering machine with a peculiar snappy answer which he wants for making a film with. I have dialed out the number for New York. And nothing seems to happen.
The number you have reached, 533-6686, has been disconnected. 533-6686 has been disconnected. No further information is available about 533-6686.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Wavelength. I'm William English. Today, Alan Bridges, inventor, talks about perpetual motion. Alan would welcome any feedback and is actively seeking someone to assist him in fulfilling this project, particularly someone who can use computer-assisted drawing, or CAD.
Explanatory books for children. There was one about that, almost certainly. How the car works, different parts of the car, and how the engine works. And if you understand how the engine works from what is written about explaining its workings in language that could be understood by a 12-year-old, right, then you've got the ordinary mechanical mindedness of the average man, which is all you would need to understand how my thing would work if you gave yourself, say, a whole afternoon, right? It wouldn't take any longer than that for you to understand it as well as I do. And you would also understand, if we were to spend a whole afternoon on it, not only what does seem to be fairly clear about it, right? Oh, that this part would work, but also the sort of dynamic behaviour where it becomes a bit tricky, you see. You would understand the bits that I can't work out intuitively and where you've got to work it out mathematically. You would see that. You would understand it as well as I would. And if it would work, then you would understand how to make a perpetual motion machine. And if you took my drawing and built the thing according to my drawing with some trial and error, after a fair amount of time and trouble, you would get it to work. There we are. I've got information, I think, about how you can build a perpetual motion machine which would solve the world's energy problem. Not only one way of doing it, but possibly up to 10, maybe more. And if somebody else looked at what I thought of, he could make other versions. It's like a jigsaw with various parts, you know. You can, or rather a Meccano set, you see. What is in my head is ways of certain ways that I've thought of arranging these Meccano parts together to produce a particular kind of machine that would work in a certain way. But taking the machines that I've made from this Meccano set, you could take bits from one machine and bits from another machine and combine those to form a third machine, or bits left over in the box to add to, or whatever, you see. So somebody who has spent an afternoon listening to what I'd have to say might very well calculate it and find that nothing could work, right? This version won't work, that version won't work, that version, this is why, this is why, this is why. But he could then think, might then think, well, look, I can see why that won't work. Let's change this bit. Oh, that bit will work. What will the rest do? You see. So he could take the data that I'd give him, and perhaps 3 months later, he would produce a perpetual motion machine, just retaining some of the things that I would have thought of, and changing it almost out of recognition, but retaining in principle some of the things, you see. And there we are. When do you want me to stop? Right. Okay, well now, if you have a flywheel rotating, and the flywheel is rotating at, say, one revolution per second, then the outward pull of the parts of the flywheel at the periphery, say, will be of a certain value. You know, the sort of centrifugal force, as it's called. Right, that's... but if you increased the number of revs of the flywheel to 60 revolutions per second, 60 revolutions per minute or whatever, to 120, you know, doubled it, right? right, well, so what would you think would happen to the outward pull? Do you think it would increase? Perhaps you think it would double. You've doubled the speed, so the outward pull doubles. Well, actually, it doesn't. It increases by four times, and as it's put, commonly put, increases at the square of the speed. Four times. Right. Now, the thing is, to get your flywheel to go twice as fast, you don't have to feed in four times the amount of propulsive effort, whether you call that power or energy or whatever, propulsive effort. It will probably be twice as much, I don't know. So you're getting something for nothing there, but the thing is, you can't do anything with it. There are some machines, a limited number of machines that utilize centrifugal force, but not many. There are governors, centrifugal clutches, centrifugal pumps, and a few other things. But that's it. But otherwise, centrifugal force is a nuisance more than anything else. It's got to be allowed for in the design of things, and because if things go round too quickly, then there could be too much of a strain on the parts of the machine, you know, because of the outward pull. But nothing has been done, it seems, so far to try to utilize this force to produce propulsive effort. So what you have, as everybody knows now, is that when you rotate something, that is, when something is moving with a torque, which is a force acting in rotation, I believe, something rotates, and when anything rotates, centrifugal force acts on it. But so that is an effect which is a useless effect. It does nothing normally, and it's not. It only has a limited range of applications. But if you could take this outward force, which pulls radially along a string, if you're, say, rotating a conker on the end of a string, swinging it round, if you could take that outward force acting radially from the centre of rotation and deflect it through 90 degrees so that it acts tangentially, and the outward force then augments the torque that has been previously set up by some external means of setting this system in rotation, then, to begin with, the outward force would augment the starting torque, if you like. But as it augmented it, it would increase the speed of the rotation thing, which would increase the centrifugal force. So you'd get a sort of dynamic chain reaction set up, whereby The increasing centrifugal force will produce more rotational effort, which will increase the rate of rotation, which will increase the centrifugal force, which will increase the feeding back like that, you see. So if you can do that, then you've solved the world's energy problem. And maybe I have done that. And in more than one way. I've started off with the First World War fighter aircraft engine, the rotary engine, which had the whole of the cylinder block rotating with the propeller, right? After a few years, that was changed, and the rotary became the radial. But we're talking about the rotary now. And if you take that engine and take off the cylinder heads, take out the valves, take off everything except the cylinder block, the crankshaft, the pistons and the connecting rods, right? And if you were then to mount the crankshaft solidly on something and rotate the whole cylinder block, then as it rotated, it would move the pistons round within it and also the connecting rods that connect the pistons to the crank, which is held stationary in this case. And as the whole thing rotated, if there were no friction at all, no air resistance or whatever, that cylinder block would rotate forever. It would be just like a flywheel set in rotation, in a frictional system, okay? Now, if you went up into space with your flywheel and the spaceman went out of the spaceship and rotated it like that, and it went round, it would go round forever. But actually, it wouldn't go round forever because photons and the vacuum of space isn't a perfect vacuum, as we all know. Every 20 yards, there's half an atom or something, you know. Well, these half an atoms we'd be banging into this thing. So after 20 zillion years, it would sort of be a little bit slower, you know. Sort of but you see the principle. So our rotary aero engine goes round forever. And I think that is called, as it's been put to me by somebody, the conservation of angular momentum. There's no friction. But what is happening within that mechanism? Right. The cylinder block is going round. The crankshaft is stationary. The pistons are going round. And each piston is mounted in its own cylinder. And if we take a piston at, say, the 6 o'clock position, right, and we imagine the cylinder block rotating in an anti-clockwise direction, then just as the piston moves away from its 6 o'clock position, it moves round, and it moves round through 180 degrees up to its 12 o'clock position. And as it does that, it is being forcibly accelerated, because where it was within the cylinder ball at the 6 o'clock position was at a fairly, at the nearest point to the axis of the cylinder block. Whereas when it gets round to the 12 o'clock position with the cylinder block going round 180 degrees and the cylinder ball then with its piston is at the 12 o'clock position, the piston at that point is at the other end of the ball. The cylinder, which is now pointing upwards to 12 o'clock. But in its path through 180 degrees from the 6 o'clock position round to the 12 o'clock position, as the piston was moving round with the cylinder, which is moving with the cylinder block, so it is moving radially outwards from the centre to the periphery, and as it does so, it accelerates. It's being forcibly accelerated. Now, as that is happening, it is exerting a resistance to that. It's as if you're going along in your car, and you put your foot down on the accelerator. You can feel your body being pressed against the seat of the car. Okay, well, that's how the piston would feel as it presses against the trailing face of the cylinder bore in the block that's rotating it. So that is, apparently, as somebody put it to me, called a Coriolis force. Coriolis, right? So you get this resistance through 180 degrees until you get to the 12 o'clock position. But then what happens, to put it briefly, through the remaining 120 degrees of rotation, 180 degrees, sorry, 180 degrees, half circle rotation, is that then the piston decelerates, right? So on the one hand, you've got a force that is acting to retard the cylinder block, but through 180 degrees, but then on the other side, that force is acting to speed it up. So what is taken out on one side is put back on the other. But let's suppose this were all happening without any friction. Then it would go on forever. And so that's the basic mechanism that I've taken, because what is happening with those pistons is that even though when they rotate, centrifugal force is acting on them, and there is a pull from the centre of the piston to what is holding the piston in place, namely the crankshaft, nothing is happening except that the forces are acting on the various component parts. The connecting rod is being pulled, the force of tension is set up in it, which could break it if it were to be too much for it to bear. But apart from that, nothing is happening. But maybe you can take this outward force of a body which is acting through a distance. It moves along the cylinder bore in a straight line in relation to that axis. If you can take that linear motion, then using one of the standard mechanisms for converting linear motion into rotary motion, if that linear motion can be converted into rotary motion, and that rotary motion can be dealt with it in such a way that the outward force is swung round through 90 degrees to act in the direction of rotation exactly, then an inertial force would, for the first time in human history, be shown to produce propulsive effort in a way that would sustain itself in a kind of feedback dynamic chain reaction. There we are. It means that you've got perpetual motion, and these people can't handle that. They can't believe that the guy who phoned them up, you know, 2 weeks ago to say, oh, I've got a thought of a perpetual motion machine, can I come and explain it to you? Yeah, come along, son, you know, I've got a half an afternoon when I'm not doing much next week, you know, show up, you know, sort of thing. So I sort of go halfway across London or halfway across the country to spend 2 hours to explain this contraption to this fellow. But all he has to do is just go to the door of his office when he hears a knock, you know. So I go sort of 200 miles, he walks 2 yards, and so it costs him nothing just to sort of say, yes, show up, you know, and then I sit down and show him my drawings. And I think he probably thinks, oh, well, this guy knows nothing about engineering or physics. After about 10 minutes of him explaining his thing, I'll be able to explain why it can't work, you know. But I think, you know, after 10 minutes, in most cases, the guy has not found that he can keep up with my explanation. He's too proud to ask me to repeat what I've just said. So he falls further behind. So he pretends that he's following me. He's either doing that, or he completely understands what I'm saying and becomes dumbstruck as it seems to have happened in a couple of cases, when I've closely observed the reaction of the people who I've been explaining it, the thing to. They keep their thoughts to themselves. I think what has happened in at least one case, and I know that it's happened in one case because the person later told me that it did happen, and there was no reason for him to have said that it did if it hadn't, is that they thought flashes across their minds. There might be something in this. Whereas before they saw my drawings, there was absolutely no reason for them to think that anybody would ever think a way of achieving perpetual motion, which they simply assumed without question was just inherently impossible. But now there is the question, oh, maybe there's something in this, which calls into question their whole belief system, if you like. And that's too much for them, I think. Well, for one thing, they think that because it hasn't been done yet, and because there's a general awareness of a vast number of people in trying to invent perpetual motion machines, and their ideas being examined and found to be unworkable, right? That it just can't be done, they think, you see. And they can't quite, and they, even though if it ever is done, it's going to be somebody who will think of it, and that somebody will then talk about it to somebody else, right? So that will be the first time in human history that somebody will have thought of an idea of a perpetual motion, which is which is an idea that will work, which he explains to somebody else, right? So he thinks of it first. That's the first time it's ever been thought of. He then explains it to somebody else. That's the first time in human history that somebody has invented a perpetual motion machine and communicated that information to somebody else, right? Now, that's got to happen, if it's ever going to happen, unless the guy keeps it to himself and doesn't tell anybody, all right? So they cannot believe that these historical moments are happening now. Sitting in this guy's office, you know, with his sort of plastic cup of crappy coffee on the table and so on, you know, and he's thinking, can I get away early? Because I can beat the roadworks or whatever and get home to see the Channel 4 News or something like that. There is just the unreasoning conviction amounting to almost blind faith that this cannot be done. And I think what underpins this is the feeling that it's as if it could be done using the means available to the mechanical engineer, then it's something that could have been done 200 or 300 years ago. And it means that if somebody had thought of what's just been thought of now by little me, you know, had been thought of 300 years ago, it would have meant that the whole Industrial Revolution would have taken a different direction, right? And we wouldn't have all this problem of global warming insofar as it's caused by human activity and burning fossil fuels and so on and so forth, you know. Everything would have been different. And they just couldn't bring themselves to think this only because what this guy has thought of now, nobody else thought of 300 years ago. It's as if the power of the thought of the thinking of one person could have such a profound effect. And they cannot believe that thing which could have happened 300 years ago didn't happen then. It's happening today in this guy's office, with a plastic cup of coffee on the table, and him wanting to, you know, is thinking, well, this has gone on for long enough. You know, I want to get home. I'm gonna listen. Right. Well, what I want is to discuss these mechanisms with a suitably qualified person, ideally somebody who can use fairly sophisticated software modelling tools such as SolidWorks, And he has enough of the SolidWorks suite of software to be able to not only model the mechanisms, but also do a dynamic analysis. And he can do this reasonably quickly. And he's sufficiently well trained to be able to do the work without relying on the software. Because that means that he would probably be able to save time. Instead of that, he would be able to do whatever, however he would go about this, he would use the shortest way of doing it. So if he could work something out just by doing a few diagrams, you know, drawn on paper with a few calculations, if that would be the quickest way of doing that part of the work, he would do that rather than laboriously modelling it. On the other hand, if a part of the mechanism was sufficiently complex for it only to be able to be dealt with adequately by modelling it, he would do it like that without trying to do it in the old-fashioned way where you draw it all out with drawing instruments and so on. Oh, well, then that would do that, and I would know. I would know that it's if he examined all enough of the versions to be able to see what are the fundamental features of all these different versions, and where the inherent sort of error is, right, or errors that amount to making the thing unworkable, then I would know. I would know why it is that it can't work. But almost certainly what he would find, I think, to begin with at any rate, at worst, is that some parts of the mechanism would work, which is taking one particular version, right? Again, of which I think I can say I've thought of about possibly 15 or more in outline. Some of them I've forgotten, right? Some of them I've just sort of done a very abbreviated drawing of, just to remind me. But if I were to take this abbreviated drawing, which I may have forgotten most of the meaning of, actually, it might take me a couple of hours looking at this, just drawing on the, almost on the back of an envelope, to see what it all means. And I thought, oh, yes, it's that, yes, yes, I see, yes. It could take a whole afternoon or so to explain that particular version. So I'm a bit lazy, actually. I mean, I should draw things out more in full, just to remind myself of the of all the work that I've put into this. But there again, I mean, part of me thinks, well, it can't work anyway, because I don't think I've solved the world's energy problem. I don't think I have. And I think that if somebody were to examine all these mechanisms, he'd find out why they can't work. And then I'd know. I'd go on to one of my other projects. I've got two or three other projects. There we are. So I would have stopped having spent 10 years on this, I would realise that I've wasted 10 years of my life, but I wouldn't waste any more of it. That would be the end of wasting my time.
Got the maths anyway. So how Yes, but they're not going to do it
on air. It would only take half an hour.
They're not going to solve 18 years' worth of work.
No, yes, they are.
On air.
No, but I mean, they could solve it in a couple of hours.
Yes, but they're not just working for you. It's just an opportunity.
No,
if I
turn up and I'm presented to them as a guy who's got some ideas for perpetual motion, either they want to hear my ideas or they don't.
Mm.
Now, they can't just hear them. They can't just look at a drawing. It's got to be properly analysed, which means I've got to properly explain it.
Mm.
They've got to be properly listening. And after 20 or 30 minutes, they will say, well, look, we can't make any sense of what you're saying.
Mm.
This doesn't seem to add up. There's no way we can analyse this. according to the sort of the criteria of engineering mathematics.
They might say, this sounds like an interesting idea, we need to do the maths, we'll get back to you. But in the process, you will have had the exchange with them, won't you? That's what this is.
Yeah, but if they're going to say, if they're going to reply with what you've just said they might reply with, that would be after a couple of hours of listening to me, explaining it, and having a proper discussion with them.
You might have to meet them more than once then.
Well, I will, yes. I will have to meet them about 20 times.
But if you don't meet them at all, then how are you going to start the conversation?
Yeah, but the thing is,
Hugh, you can't expect people to meet you 20 times.
No.
Until you've given them the first
If I spent an hour explaining this, and he was properly listening, and he properly understood, and if he's, very importantly, if the person has, which you might think of a rather trivial, why are you saying that? Good freehand drawing skills, right? Mm. An engineer is at least used to be taught technical drawing, and you can get quite far with thumbnail sketches, right? Just on the back of an envelope. If he's capable of that, and I should think he has gotten an interest in machinery, otherwise he wouldn't be at the Science Museum, because it's all machines, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Then you will say, well, yes, it looks as if this would work. Mm. You say you've got other ideas, what are they? And I say, well, look, we've been talking for 2 hours now. We could carry on talking until 8 o'clock tonight. I mean, if he thinks that any of my ideas are likely to work, he will want to carry on talking to me, because I will be giving him information about how you can do away with all present means of generating power that puts carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Right.
So it's in your best interest to speak to such a person then, isn't it?
Yes, but the thing is, now you see, what has happened up to now, when I have spoken to people, I get no feedback from them. They sit there.
Mm.
They don't even sit up to the table properly.
Mm.
It's as if there's a sort of Bolshy attitude of, like, who do you think you are, you know? And there is no proper proper discussion where I say something, they say something in reply, they ask me to clarify what I've said, they point something out or whatever. It doesn't go like that. They sit there with a sort of silly grin on their faces, while I'm going on for half an hour, an hour, 2 hours, with no feedback from them. Because, why is that?
Why? Because people...
Because they don't... Because, tell you why I think it is. It's because they are not sure. They are probably people who haven't done any engineering maths for years, right? Now, when I went to Kingston and had that formal interview for a place there with Mike Rain and his colleague, I said to his colleague, you know, I was sitting on one side of the table there, but it was a proper sort of, they had to sort of at least put on a show of a sort of interview, you know. And I just said to this other chap, Dave Edmondson, Dr. Dave Edmondson. Hmm. Now, he has a doctorate in electronic engineering, where he wrote a doctorate on the subject of some aspect of the transistor, which was being developed at the time that he was in his 20s or so. You know, a very clever guy. He was working at administration or something, you know. Guy in his sort of late 60s, I suppose he was by then. And I said to him, well, all that's needed for this, really, is just some basic vector analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, I haven't done anything like that for about 20 years.
Uh-huh. But that doesn't mean to say that everybody you meet is going to be like that, does it?
No. But the thing is, you see, at least he was prepared to admit that. So he had forgotten everything that he had learnt as an undergraduate before he became an undergraduate, A-level.
But the person that you might meet is not in that position. He's an active person.
Yeah, probably, yes.
Actually, rather than probably, he actually is.
Right, well, not probably. We can assume that, but the thing is, if I show him a sort of geometrical construction like this, you see, at this stage, it's just sort of, as I said, dry as dust, engineering mathematics, mainly geometry and vector analysis.
Yeah,
there's not a huge amount of it. It's not at a very high standard.
Yes, yes, yes. If in the
O-level, A-level. Yeah,
fine.
Halfway between
right.
the two.
Well, in the first 20 minutes or so, it's up to you to sell the idea or to...
I can't sell anything. I can simply say, as I've said to all these people who I used to go to at universities, where I tell the person on the phone, just in 10 minutes, I've got an idea, the idea for generating power that, if it would work, amounts to perpetual motion. I haven't had any training in engineering myself. I've just worked this out sort of intuitively. It takes about a couple of hours for me to explain it. I've got some drawings which I can bring along, and I want to find somebody who will analyse this and do what I can't do. And that invariably, almost always, they've said, yes, well, you can come along. You know, and they sort of, it's arranged for us 10 days later or something,
mm-hmm.
2 hours. So I go halfway across the country,
mm.
costing, I don't know how much it would cost now, about 150 quid or something like that.
Right.
I get there.
You're not doing anything else?
So it's taken 6 hours to get there, 4 to 6 hours.
Yeah.
Another 4 hours to get home. I've got 2 hours.
Right.
And they just sit there and say nothing.
Yeah. Well, that's presumably because they're sceptical.
Well,
about
yes,
the.
But they've never ever said to me, "Well, look."
No, but presumably you know that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of people who have all tried to crack the problem of perpetual motion,
mm.
and it is a magnet for people who are either cranks or.
The thing is, what I will say about that, I didn't set out to see if I could find a way of achieving perpetual motion. I thought of something that could be done, that could be used as a propulsive force, namely perpetual motion, but not just that, other things as well. And it was only a little later on that I realised that if it would work, it would amount to perpetual motion.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're saying if it would work?
Well, it would be perpetual motion because it would be an engine that works without any fuel.
Right, OK. So what's the next step then?
Well, the next step is having we get back to the same thing. Getting some, either I learn the engineering maths myself, which would take about a year,
mm.
right? But I haven't done that, partly because I'm lazy, partly because I don't have sufficient faith in my own ideas,
mm.
and partly because there are plenty of people who can do it already,
mm.
you know. I shouldn't have to learn it all.
No, okay.
I mean, you know how the ordinary car engine works, don't you? You know that the piston goes up, and the spark lights the fuel, and it pushes mm. it down like a cannonball in a,
right,
a
yeah.
cannon being pushed down.
Okay,
then,
so what's this
you question? Understand all that?
Right.
Well, that's the level at which I understand this. Now, if nobody had ever invented.
Yeah, but the point is that this goes.
You would have been capable of thinking.
But the
it
reason
out.
That people, the reason that people are sceptical about it is mm. that that apparently it goes against the laws of physics, doesn't it?
Well, I don't see how. Which laws of physics? That's what they always say.
Right.
Well, what laws?
Well, 99% of.
Well, which
people...
laws of physics? Yeah, yeah. They do say something like that. But what right. laws of physics?
Well, that you can't get more energy out of something than you put into it.
Well, I'm not. Well, my answer to that is that you don't need to talk about energy. Energy is a nebulous concept, right? Engineers and other people were sort of designing machines, various sort of contraptions that worked before anybody had the notion of energy or worked it out in the sort of formalised way that they did with the sort of mathematical treatment of it in the 19th century. Before then, people used to make things that worked and you know, like water wheels and what have you. They just knew, oh, well, you've got water, you pushes against a vein and it goes round and there's another vein that comes, you know. I mean, just some ordinary mechanical mindedness of the ordinary guy.
This is the conversation that you could have with somebody else. You could talk about it exactly as you've spoken about it just then.
Yeah, I could do, but the thing is,
Can't talk about it from a mathematical or a physical point of view because you don't have the knowledge. So you talk about it like that.
Well, I do have something like the knowledge, intuitively, but there are things that I can't work out formally.
Therein lies the problem. That's the rub, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't know whether it works or it doesn't because you don't have the know-how.
No, but the thing is,
it's not an intuitive problem, actually, is it? It's not abstract. It's not an abstract concept.
Well, it's not abstract in that I start off with
I don't mean you. I mean anybody trying to solve this problem.
Right.
Can't approach it theoretically in that way.
No. You have an idea for a piece of machinery or some mechanical device.
Yes.
I mean, that's specific,
people...
not abstract. Mm. Yes. But it's got to work according to principles that are abstract, that it's got to be such that you can apply to it the standard way of examining things of that type, you see.
So where do you stand, where are you now with this project?
Well, I think I've got a lot further because I've thought of much simpler versions than I started off with. Like when Nathan Sebastian came round, we were talking about that rotary aero engine version, which was really quite complicated. But I was able to explain it to him, and also a couple.
So what did he say?
Well, he just said when we got ready to go, and if he hadn't left when he had, he would have missed the last train home. Because then I went with him to get the district line.
No, what did he say about the invention?
No, what he said was that he would see if he could find anybody in the physics department where he was an undergraduate at Imperial College.
At Imperial College?
He complained that... Yeah, that's where he went. And he complained that... he complained that he was burdened with a lot of information overload, you know, that we'd been talking, discussing the thing for about 4 hours. We went out into the kitchen from time to time and I made some coffee and what have you. He said that his algebra was good and that he was up to doing the mathematics, but he didn't have an engineering... That there was one point, there were two critical points in the... One thing that I've found with people, they either sit there, instead of sitting up to the table to look at the drawings that I have on the table, they sort of sit back like this with a sort of non-committal look, you know. They don't say anything, hardly say anything. They're not cooperating with me. There's this sort of standoff, you know.
But they've accepted the proposition of seeing you. They are willing to hear you.
They never want to study the drawings. Right. I've got drawings to show. They don't look at the drawings. Now, one thing that I have learned, that the person is actually psychologically committed to properly cooperating with me insofar as he's prepared to seriously listen to what I'm saying and say whatever he thinks. If at a certain point he interrupts and says something like, well, what you mean is this then, is it? And then he re-expresses in his own words what I have been saying up until then for about 10 minutes, so that he can be sure that he has understood me properly, you see. And I know then that the person isn't playing silly buggers, that he just wants to make sense of what... And because that there are a lot of things that we're talking about and in somewhat general terms, as even though I've got a drawing there, it's not quantified, you see. He's got to sort of have the mechanical intuition to follow me and to sort of mentally put some figures on the thing, even if just tentatively, so that he can see if there's a sort of if what I'm saying seems coherent, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And what Nathan Sebastian did about two-thirds of the way through our discussion, I was explaining something that wasn't shown on the drawing, because I hadn't thought of that but at the time I made the drawing. It was a sort of development of my thinking, and I said, well, if you can do it like this and what have you, it's not shown on the drawing, what's the... At least, oh yes, but if you're going to do that, you would need bevel gears, wouldn't you? And I thought, he's completely understood what I've said.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't say anything about bevel gears, right?
Right.
So, you see, it comes down to things that are not particularly interesting for somebody who isn't interested in mechanical engineering. Most people aren't.
No, but these are the nuts and bolts of... Yes. Your invention,
yes,
which is about perpetual motion.
Yeah.
So obviously the stakes are incredibly high.
They are, they? Yes.
So although you're talking about beveled gears and nuts and bolts, the stakes are astronomical.
It consists of things like beveled gears and nuts and bolts and linkages and bearings.
Well, then people will be interested. If the idea proves to be so important, then of course anyone's going to be interested.
Mm. You see, look, one version. This here, right? Let me just look.
Well, could I take your? What about? Have you got any drawings that I can?
Now, watch what happens here, right? Now you see, if any of these ideas work, it's not terribly exciting. It's just the ordinary mechanism, right? Anybody else could have thought of it any time in the last 500 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And what it will amount to is that since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, the whole world has been involved in a huge mistake. It's gone in the direction of generating power. To get electricity, say you switch the light on and what have you, mm. and read, you've got this huge place, power station, a huge cooling towers, vast amounts of coal going into the place if it's coal. I mean, covering about sort of 10, 20 acres or something like that, you know.
Right.
Loads of people working there.
Yeah.
And that's just to get electricity.
Well, yeah, so are you going to bypass this then?
Oh, yes, telling me. That can all be scrapped.
Uh-huh.
The whole lot can be scrapped. At any one time, there are about 40 nuclear power stations being built in the world, all over the world, you know, Argentina.
Yeah.
God knows where.
Right.
There would be no point in finishing any of them. Right. As soon as somebody who's going to be taken seriously goes on air to say, well, I've examined this person's ideas and the maths work out, you know, it's going to cause a tremendous bombshell.
Mm-hmm.
What's Russia going to do? It would completely collapse if it didn't...
The sooner you get somebody to speak to you, the better.
Oh, right, yeah. And another thing, I could be dead next week, mm-hmm. right? I'm 65 now,
mm-hmm.
not in terribly good health. It's mm-hmm. my fault. I've got I haven't spent every moment of my life for the last 18 years puzzling over these contraptions. But, I mean, that's what's taken up all my energy, more or less, you see.
Mm.
And I've probably got enough material for about a week with two or three engineers, including my original thing, the rotary aero engine thing, which is sort of ancient history now. But like, for example, the simple thing like, let's suppose you have something here, right? Now, you apply a twist to this rod, right? And there's an arm on the end of it, okay? And this arm comes against something like that. Like that, right? And you twist it. And that forces the arm down, you see. Now that is an essential action that this depends on, right?
Right.
It's that simple, you know.
Uh-huh.
Right, now there's another version where you have this, you have this twist, and you have the arm, but then you have another arm, right, which is longer than that one. And that turns like that, and it applies a force of a certain magnitude, upwards, say, right, like that. But if there's another arm there, and it's longer to there, say, then as that goes up, so this goes down.
Mm-hmm.
But because this is shorter, it will apply a greater force, which would be a torque to turn the whole mechanism round, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would apply a greater force than the other force acting in the opposite direction.
Well, that's called leverage, isn't it?
Well, yes. Well, actually, all these things are just assemblies of levers.
Mm.
That's what they are, basically.
Right.
You see. Right, now.
Well, I seem to vaguely remember back in the mists of time, there was a sort of school diagram which showed that you could almost lift the sun up if you had a sort of long enough lever or something
right,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well... Mm.
So it's kind of in that area.
We're not trying to do anything sort of theoretically possible, practically impossible like that.
No, but it's to do with sort of leverage. It all depends on the length of the lever, doesn't it?
Right. Now this here, with the second arm, right, you could liken that to a tug of war between two teams, right? Now, if one team is overcoming the other team, Team A is pulling with greater force than Team B, then Team A is going to pull Team B in the direction that Team A is moving in, right? I mean, it might struggle, but it will achieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've got, say, five strong men pulling on a rope...
That's because they're bigger men.
Okay, but five strong men and one strong man pulling in the opposite direction...
Yeah, but this isn't the answer to perpetual motion, is it?
Well, it is, yes. Oh. Because I'm making use of that in a particular way. Then the team of five men are going to pull the one man...
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that he can do about it. What that one man will do will be he will be opposing a counterforce to their greater force. And if they didn't have him pulling against their propulsive effort, right? Then they would pull with more force.
I think you should stick to the diagrams you've got.
Yeah.
I'm suggesting to you that you bring the diagrams to the Science Museum and show them to either to Professor Heyman
for half
an hour or the curator of mechanical engineering.
Yeah. What it
you
means,
can talk to either one of them for half an hour.
This is what I'm going to be showing them. I could talk for about 2 hours about this version.
Right.
Probably an hour... about that, an hour about that, and that, and this, and some basic mathematical working out there. Another 3/4 of an hour about that, right? So, I mean, what's he going to do when he sees his work? Don't waste my time. I mean, if you want to talk to me, then do some proper drawings and come along and we'll look at them. He's got to make the best of, because I could come along with a sketch pad, right, and I can draw all the, and so if he's got a good visual imagination, if he really wants to understand what I've got to explain to him, and if he's prepared to make a proper contribution, it won't matter that I've got these tacky what's it here, you know, sketches, and this here. He will say, well, okay, explain this, and if he himself has got a good visual imagination and has good freehand drawing skills, he will be able to do his own drawing. You see, I'll be able to show him whatever it is.
Here. You'd have to, in order to, for someone like that.
And this is all going to take time. We've got to sit down properly.
Yeah, I know. So for somebody of like that to spend time on your project, they have to have some inkling that it's worth their time.
Well, he'll either believe dogmatically that perpetual motion is impossible, and that he would just be completely wasting his time. If he even 5 minutes, in which case I'd rather sort of just get it over and done with a sort of 10-minute discussion over the phone.
Right.
You know, because you could say, well, there's no point in you coming along.
Well, what about
everybody knows that perpetual motion is inherently impossible.
Right.
You're obviously mistaken. What I would do if I were you is learn some basic physics, and when you've done that, you know, then you'll see that your own ideas aren't any good. Goodbye. That's how it will go, you see.
Right.
Now, I don't think Professor Heyman, I think he's probably a bit more approachable and not...
You don't know how approachable the other
guy is. No, I don't. But the thing is, you see, it's happened so often. I go to see people, I tell them over the phone what it is that I've got to discuss with them. They say, yes, come along and what have you. And it's always disappointing. They just sit there and they say nothing while I'm talking about the things.
It's probably because
they don't ever, it hardly ever happens, that the person interjects and starts to explain in his own words what I have just said. Mike Rain did do that once. But with a very bad grace. It was the third or the fourth time I'd explain the thing to him. I think it might have been a crucial discussion that we had, because it was between me having done the first year or been enrolled in the place for 1 year, and then there was going to be the second year, you see, and I went along to see him between the two terms. He was there, the first term had finished, and I didn't know whether I would be allowed to go on to this, the second year, because nothing had been done. I'd had no help. You know, I mean, before I went along for that interview, and when I went to the interview, he knew what it was that I had some ideas for perpetual motion that I wanted to get evaluated, and I also had an idea for a new type of motorbike, an enclosed motorbike, you know, which I explained to him, and I thought, well, if my perpetual motion idea isn't any good, then, before the end of the first term, that'll get that out of the way, and I've got this other project to work on. You see, and David did some drawings for me. For instance, you know, and it's supposed to be an inherently stable cabin motorcycle that couldn't fall over, didn't have outrigger wheels.
So where do we stand now with this science museum thing?
I think that if I can see this chap, this curator of mechanical engineering or whatever it is, whoever he is.
Yeah.